The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We have a Jewish-themed episode for you this week. I know you're saying, what else is new? Hey, but these are important issues. These are important cultural touchstones, and we will cover them if necessary. I paid a visit last week to the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in Los Angeles and was a bit appalled by the Hollywoodland exhibit, which is about the Jewish founders of Hollywood. Very problematic, very, really anti-Semitic, and not, just not cool. And I have a special guest this week to talk to me about the Hollywoodland exhibit. His name is Michael Kaplan. He is a comedy writer who lives in Los Angeles. He's worked on shows like Roseanne and Frasier and Herman's Head. You remember Herman's Head? I do, but that's because I watch too much TV. I'm also going to talk to frequent contributor Rebecca Kirsten about a movie called Between the Temples, which is a lovely Jewish-themed romantic dramedy. I don't know exactly what the genre is. It starts Jason Schwartzman and Carol Kane, and it is the most unpretentiously Jewish movie of the year, and Rebecca will be along in a little bit to talk to me about it. But first, we're going to talk to Michael Kaplan about the Hollywoodland exhibit at the Academy Museum, and he'll be here to talk to me about it right after this musical interlude. So I was in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago on a series of side quests to my actual life, and I decided as part of one of those side quests that I would visit the Academy Museum in central LA, and that's the museum that the Motion Picture Academy, the people who do the Academy Awards, they built, and it opened in 2021, and I've been meaning to get there for quite a while, and so I went, and you know, there's a lot to recommend with the Academy Museum. There is a wonderful temporary exhibit about the films of Pedro Almodovar, and there is an amazing room, two rooms really, about the making of The Godfather that I lingered in for quite a while. But then there are some more troubling aspects to the museum, and I stopped by the third floor to an exhibit called Hollywoodland, which is basically about, purports to be about the Jewish studio moguls who created modern Hollywood. And this exhibit was met with a lot of controversy when it opened because it contained some extremely problematic features, and those features were removed, but I was appalled when I went in. I felt like the exhibit was extremely anti-Semitic. I mean, I know my radar is very very sensitive to these kinds of things, but it was pretty obvious to me that whoever made the exhibit did not really like Jews that much. And so I started doing some digging. I talked to Rob Kuttner, who's a frequent contributor to Book and Film Globe and to this podcast. And he said he was part of a Writers Guild of America, chat group or Slack or something that had been protesting Hollywoodland when it came out. And I don't have Rob with me here today. He's extremely busy. But I do have Michael Kaplan, who is a television writer, who was a writer for Roseanne and Friends, and most importantly, Dog with the Blog, which I didn't realize had more than 60 episodes. So a very successful show, very successful TV writer. And he is here today to talk to me about Hollywoodland. Hello, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I do want to correct one thing just for the sake of, in the interest of accuracy. I did not write on Friends. I did write on Frasier, the other single
Frasier
word show.
Oh, much
that begins
better.
With an F and FR. Easily confused on at the same time.
Same general era, but actually a better show. So you're a better writer for it. So I apologize for that error, but we won't make any other mistakes on this segment. So all right, so Hollywoodland, right? I mean, you went to see this when it first opened, right?
I saw it a few times, yes. I have not seen it since they made their supposed corrections, fixes, whatever you want to call them. So I don't know what it looks like today. My understanding is that the fixes were fairly minimal and
superficial.
Certainly, superficial. Thank you. That's a good word. You know, that they didn't completely redo it, which is what you know, I was part of a group of people who signed a letter calling for them to basically start from scratch and give the Jewish founders the respect and celebration and due that they deserve, and which yeah. they make an effort to give to the people that they honor in every other section of the museum, some of whom you just mentioned. So they didn't do any of that. They just made some cosmetic. That's the word I was looking for, cosmetic changes.
Right. Well, when the exhibit initially opened, the walls were festooned with words like predator, harasser, racist.
Words like that, yes. I mean, I know predator was one of them. Here, let's see. Womanizer, tyrant. They reference oppressive control and prejudices. They use the word frugal, which is not always a bad thing, but certainly when talking about Jews is a bit of a stereotyping buzzword. So they used a bunch of words like that. And this was not like, you know, 10 words amidst thousands of words. These were fairly brief, one paragraph descriptions of the various Jewish founders, Harry Cohen and Jack Warner and Carl Laemmle. And so, you know, in one paragraph, if three of the words you use are womanizer, tyrant, and oppressive, then it's clearly painting a picture.
Well, here's the thing, right? Hollywoodland went up because when the museum originally opened, there was a bit of an outcry that the museum hadn't paid any attention to or respect for the Jews who created Hollywood, right? So they said, all right, we'll give you something.
Exactly. They were completely left out. And, you know, I think a lot of people were surprised by that, given that Hollywood was literally founded by Jews. And a lot of people were offended by that, given that it seemed to be hard to make an oversight like that without it being intentional. You know, it's not like, oh my gosh, I forgot my second cousin's birthday, I feel badly. This is, you know, you can't make that kind of oversight without making a decision to make that kind of oversight. So yeah, there was a bit of an uproar, and they decided to address it with this Jewish Founders exhibit. I believe what's the full name of it? It's
Hollywoodland, Jewish Founders and the Making of a Movie Capital.
There you go. That's what it is. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So here's the thing. Like I went to this sort of revamped exhibit a couple of weeks ago, and the big words are off the wall. But basically what you have, you know, I mean, this again, like I said, not like The Godfather doesn't deserve two rooms. It's one of the greatest, if not the greatest film ever made by Hollywood. But here's what you have. You have a little bit of a map, an interactive map showing how Hollywood LA was like an oil backwater until the studios moved in, and it basically like shows the LA area evolving traffic wise, making the studio head seem like the ultimate gentrifiers, which maybe they were, but you know, a little bit odd. And then there were these brief.
Well, you know, the argument could be made that traffic is one of Hollywood's greatest contributions to Southern California, so
or to human history, right? Okay, that's fine. But then you had these like eight little biographies of the major studios. And then there's a movie. There's a side room with a movie edited by Ben Mankiewicz, himself the product of one of the great Hollywood Jewish families, that essentially says that the Jewish studio heads created an idealized vision of America because they were racist and they hated themselves. And so they not only did not include any positive images of Black or Hispanic or Asian people, they also didn't include any positive images of Jewish people. And that's pretty much the whole exhibit. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. And I will just say, you promised not to make another mistake, and I think you may have just broken that promise. I'm really feel badly about bringing this up, but Ben Mankiewicz narrated the film. I'm not sure he edited it. Did he edit it as well?
No, I didn't. Did I say he edited it? I mean,
I think he used the word edited. So I'm just
that's certainly a mistake. But he's narrated it. You know, he contributed.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, he's the voice. And I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine he wrote that script himself. He's probably just reading something someone else wrote. But maybe he wrote it himself. I don't know. But I found the whole thing extremely off-putting And, you know, and here's the thing, like, I'm Jewish and, you know, I hate myself as much as anybody, but I also am proud of Jewish history and culture. And I lived in L.A. for a few years. You know, L.A. has a very strong, vibrant Jewish culture, so, but there's nothing in the exhibit about the synagogues and the delis and the summer camps and all the good stuff about being a Jew in L.A. It's sort of a, it's a promised land for Jewish people in a lot of ways. And there also wasn't any content from, you know, Jewish content for movies. What about the, there wasn't much about the jazz singer. They didn't show anything from The Great Dictator. They didn't show any, no clip for Bientel. What's going on there?
Well, I, you know, and to that point, I think the purpose of the entire museum is to celebrate Hollywood and the accomplishments of those who, you know, founded and work in and have worked in Hollywood. There was no celebration in the Jewish Founders exhibit. That really was the part that was missing. And it really comes into stark contrast when you compare it to, say, the thing, some of the other things you've mentioned, the Godfather exhibit or the, you know, Almodovar, or there was a John Waters exhibit.
Boys in the Hood.
Yeah. Or Boys in the Hood. I mean, there were a lot of places where it really was celebrating the achievements and accomplishments, and that sense of celebration is completely missing from the Jewish Founders exhibit, and as is the sense of fun. I mean, you go to the Godfather exhibit, and there is the actual desk that Vito Corleone sat behind. You see the Casablanca thing, and there's you know, Sam's piano. There's some really cool artifacts from Hollywood to see. There is literally nothing like that in the Jewish Founders exhibit, partly because it's very small. There's probably not room for anything like that. But also because that's clearly not the point of it. It's not a celebration. It's not a honoring.
It doesn't like Jews. I wanted to see Barbra Streisand's Tallis. I wanted to see Tevye's hat. A picture of Richard Benjamin. Anything.
Well, in fairness, it's not called Jews in Hollywood. It's called Jewish Founders. And the examples you just referenced were not part of the founding period of Hollywood. On the one hand, on the other hand, there are plenty of great movies that were made during the founding period of Hollywood, and I would hope artifacts from those movies that could have been included, as they did with, say, The Godfather or Casablanca. So absolutely. I mean, I agree with you, actually, that it would have been nice if it was extended beyond just the founders and talked about, you know, Spielberg and you know, the various others through the years. But
and Mel Brooks
absolutely.
And Woody Allen. On and on. You know, that's the thing. It's obviously like the Jewish Founders had nothing to do with the making of Annie Hall or something like that. But the idea that that's the bone they would try to throw, you know, there are many, many prominent Jews helped found and fund this museum, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that was one of the surprising things to me is, you know, I mean, I think Spielberg's name is on one of the sections. I think it's a large theater or something that's named after him. I mean, yeah. There were a number of Jews involved in it, but I guess they were not creatively involved. I guess they were more on the fundraising and promotional side of it or whatever role they played. If they were creatively involved in the curation of it, that would be even more disturbing, I think.
It just makes me sad. It makes me sad that, you know, this is a point, you know, the Jewish people take great pride in our contributions to the entertainment industry. And it just makes me sad that this major, major museum about the entertainment industry gives Jews such, not only short shrift, but really like offensively racist shrift.
Yeah. And, I mean, you use the word pride, which I think is something else that's completely missing because, you know, it portrays these moguls when it's not negatively portraying them. I mean, it portrays them largely as businessmen, but they actually took pride in making motion pictures. They cared about the movies they were making as producers in a way that, you know, I think a lot of us in the industry decry the degree to which our industry is now run by banks and corporations and people with a corporate mindset.
Yeah.
And you know, that to some degree they were businessmen, obviously, but there was also a sense of joy and pride and desire to support the artistry of the work they were doing. And that's completely left out as well. I mean, there's no sense or indication of that.
Agreed. And there's very little, if nothing, about, you know, how this kind of sprung out of New York vaudeville and the New York, you know, the Manhattan theater scene, and how Jews traveled, you know, west in order to create a world that, you know, was theirs.
Yeah. Or the Jewish cultural history of storytelling. You know, I mean, that's a big part of our culture. It's not an accident that this is the field that a group of Jewish immigrants went into.
Yes.
You know, it's very much in keeping with a cultural history, and that's ignored as well. But that's not the point of it. It's not there to celebrate. It's there to, you know, partly tick off a box, and I think partly tick off the people who complained.
Well, it's a Shonda. The whole thing is a Shonda, as we say. So I guess, Michael, the question is, there is a group of Jewish people in LA, you know, who are writing letters and, you know, still kvetching about this. Is there anything to be done going forward, are we just kind of left to, you know, podcast about it and write blog posts?
The short answer to that is I don't know. You know, when it first came out, there was a concerted effort to make a bit of a stink. There were a whole series of articles that were published. There was this letter, as you alluded to, which what happened was we got a bunch of articles going and a bunch of people to cover it and cover the very things that you and I are talking about in terms of how the exhibit comes up short and is even offensive. And then the museum itself, I don't know if they hired a PR team, if they did their own PR or whatever, but there was definitely a concerted PR push to counter the bad PR. And part of that included an article for the New York Times. And the point of the New York Times article was to be, it's just a handful of whiny, complaining Jews. And when a group of us heard that was kind of going to be the point that the museum was at least making to the New York Times, and presumably the New York Times was, you know, going to quote, if not adopt, we thought, well, we better show this not just a handful of us. And so we wrote a letter and got about 300 celebrities and industry professionals to sign it. And the New York Times, I think they did publish the letter. They didn't publish all the signatures, but they included some of the, you know, headline names. You know, so that was a sort of a nice moment. And the people doing the exhibit realized that, again, they had to, as they went through the motions to address the initial complaints when there was no such exhibit, they decided, well, we better go through the motions to address the complaints of what the exhibit is actually doing now. And I know that they, you know, made, again, these cosmetic changes we talked about, and they, I know, met with a number of the people who were involved with this. I am not one of the people they met with, so I don't know exactly what happened in those meetings.
Apparently not much, because it's not that different.
Yeah.
I guess to me, what really bothers me about this, right, is that, look, you and I can go to this exhibit and understand exactly why it's wrong and what has been deliberately omitted and sort of some of the stereotypes that are being perpetuated. The reason these exhibits are important is because average people who go to these aren't going to have their antenna as finely tuned to subtle anti-Semitic comments as we might, right? So this stuff just will kind of sink in. It's like how the, you know, Museum of Natural History used to portray Native Americans back in the day, right? And I feel like it's swung around to Jews in a certain sense.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the disturbing things, I've gone to it, I think just twice. I'm trying to remember now. But the first time I went, there was a school group there. It was during the week. And, you know, there was a school group being shown around. It's exactly what you're saying. You know, this is not just film buffs coming to this museum. There are school groups who come through, I think, on a very regular basis. And, you know, and they're being shown this. I think the one thing that may be of benefit or you know, works in our favor in terms of, you know, regular tourist visitors or whatever, is that this exhibit is so kind of uninviting and tucked out of the way. I don't think a lot of people are going to spend much time in it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is obviously a negative, but
it's like a stale plate of cookies after Friday night services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they are having school groups come through there and they're, you know, that's part of the tour they're being given. It's not good. And, you know, I think a lot of us also have been experiencing this, obviously, in the greater context of what's going on in the world and in the country now with rising anti-Semitism, and it's all part of a larger picture.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. We cover this on the site a lot. There are Jewish writers who are having events canceled because bookstore employees say they're Zionist. We've all seen the protests and, you know, sort of the rise in anti-Semitic rhetoric and even violence in society. And so, like, you know, this is just part of a subtle attitude on the part of, I hate to say it, on the part of progressives, because, you know, you're not, these aren't right-wing conservatives who are making museum exhibits in Hollywood. You know, that's sort of a sentiment, anti-Jewish sentiment. And I it makes me sad because that's not the world I grew up in, you know?
No, it's very disturbing. And it is definitely very much a part of the progressive worldview. You know, I mean, I could talk about that at more length. I don't know if you want to even go into that here, but
we've done it before. I just, for now, you know, if you're going to this exhibit, if you're going to be in LA to see this, please take some time to look at it with a critical eye. And, you know, if you find it offensive, drop a comment card. You know, the museum needs to continue to hear from people that this is just not okay. And this is on permanent exhibit. So I really hope that, you know, somehow if we can keep subtle pressure up, maybe they'll make some more changes.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I do think it's going to take probably another round of less than subtle pressure. You know, I mean, obviously any pressure is good, but, you know, I mean, we sort of had that round of pressure and then they said, okay, we'll deal with this. And I think at some point people are going to have to come back in a more concerted way and say, no, you didn't deal with this.
Or we can start our own museum and like in a garage in Encino or something.
Absolutely. And,
I will attend
that museum once you have it open. Let me know.
I'll donate at least $40 to it. All right, Michael Kaplan, thank you so much for talking to me about this. And thank you for fighting the good fight.
Thank you.
Mrs. O'Connor, hi.
This is a bat mitzvah class. I saw it on the website.
So you want to have a bat mitzvah?
Jeez, Benny, you're a sharp one.
Your mother has decided to have her bat mitzvah, and I'm going to give it to her.
She might be able to handle
Rabbi,
this.
If anyone can do it, it will be her. It's okay to be loud and to be sloppy.
What's the matter?
There's cheese in this meat.
Yeah,
that's not kosher.
Those two things, they go together so well.
No, why are you in my pajamas?
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Yes.
These are tough times culturally for Jewish people and the world, and in America in particular. And we just talked to a writer in Hollywood about the really troubling exhibit at the Academy Museum about the Jewish founders of Hollywood. That said, there are still Jewish creatives doing their thing and making movies and TV shows about Jewish themes. And the most Jewish movie of the year, I would say, is something called Between the Temples. It's an indie production that has been released recently in cities that host these kinds of indie movies. And I have Rebecca Kirsten here with me today, one of our frequent contributors, to talk to me about Between the Temples. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah. So we both have seen Between the Temples, and, you know, you are a practicing Jew. I perfected my Judaism, so I don't really need to practice it anymore. But, you know, it struck me at just how, like, overtly and proudly Jewish this movie was.
Yeah. I even noticed that the soundtrack just unabashedly had a mixture of Hebrew singers and sort of American indie stuff plus Israeli stuff, which was amazing. The soundtrack is phenomenal.
Right. And it's not a set in Israel. It's set in upstate New York. So it's not like this is, it's not like this is a movie about Israeli people. I mean, these are fully assimilated, reform American Jews. That's definitely a reform synagogue. There's not a lot of, yes, the main character keeps kosher, sort of, but.
Sort of.
Sort of.
But his mother keeps serving, she's making a beautiful looking brisket and then she serves it with ranch.
Yeah.
Which I've never heard of. It's a head scratcher.
Yeah, you know, everyone has their own culinary traditions. So the gist of this movie is that Jason Schwartzman plays a cantor who has lost his voice, but I feel like the reason he's lost his voice is not because he's sick, it's because he's grieving.
Yes.
Over the death of his wife, who was like an alcoholic novelist, and she died in an accident, basically. And then he comes into contact with his old music teacher, played by the wonderful Carol Kane, and just an absolutely stellar performance that I'm guessing if this movie has any publicity at all, it's going to get her an Oscar nomination for supporting actress, or at least it should. It's sort of like a late era performance, kind of like Ruth Gordon's in Rosemary's Baby, although this isn't a horror movie. Anyway, she's great, and she's an ex-music teacher, and she was married to a Jewish guy, and she decides late in life that she wants to become a bat mitzvah. And so she asks Jason Schwartzman to give her bat mitzvah lessons. That's kind of it. That's the whole story.
That's the whole story. The Ruth Gordon reference I would make is Harold and Maude, because this is a love story.
Yeah.
A strange love story. And a incredibly moving at times love story.
Yeah. The relationship is very real and it's very believable, and it's very well sort of, even though the movie only takes place over a period of like 3 or 4 weeks, it feels like it develops naturally.
I was shocked when they said she's already, you know, she's ready for this. It's been 3 weeks. I thought it had been 6 months.
Yeah. I don't know if she had 6 months, you know?
No, she seemed very ill. And I was also, there's moments that really shocked me. Her relationship with her son was
terrible.
Was shocking.
What a horrible man he is, right?
Yeah.
And it seemed like the rest of his family was perfectly nice, too. So it's bad. It's really terrible how he treats his mother. You know, and Jason Schwartzman's relationship with, I guess, his mom's, because his mother has clearly remarried to a woman who played by Dolly De Leon, who may not be an actress familiar to most people, but she was the major character in Triangle of Sadness, which was an Oscar nominee last year, and she plays a Filipina woman who is converted to Judaism, and she's way more of a Yenta than Jason Schwartzman's actual mother.
I think we've all known converts like this who get so into it that they outdo the original. I thought she was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, what a performance.
So funny, so loving, and very real.
Yeah, and then there's a couple other, I don't remember the name of the young actress who played the rabbi's daughter, but I thought she was very good.
I think it's Caroline Aaron.
Caroline Aaron played Schwartzman's mother.
Oh, I'm way off.
Yeah.
She's wonderful. I remember her from so many different Woody Allen movies.
Yes. Yeah. She's
just
a veteran.
Fantastic.
And the rabbi himself is a great comic side character. And he's played by Robert Smigel, who is the voice of Triumph the Insult comic dog from the Conan O'Brien show. And he's a sort of a classic, legendary SNL writer. And he hasn't done a lot of acting, but I thought he was very funny too. You know, he was very believable as a role.
He was, oh my gosh. Yes, he was completely believable, but not played in a goofy way or an obnoxious way. No. Just as a real person.
Yeah.
Very, very likable.
Cause he's not really an actor. So, you know, and to his credit, he didn't try too hard. He was just kind of being himself. I thought that the movie itself, I mean, it's a great story and I enjoyed it. I did think that it was a bit twitchy.
Yes.
You know, there are a lot of close-ups, a lot of, scenes kind of melding into each other, some sort of ambiguous time stuff going on. I just felt like the director, he was trying in some ways too hard to be like John Cassavetes, right? Like in reality this was a Nathan Silver is his name, not Nate Silver, the founder of 528, but like Nathan Silver. I felt like he you know, really this movie is more like a romantic comedy in the vein of like you said, Harold and Maude, or you know, or Nancy Myers or a James L. Brooks film. And
yeah.
I felt like, you know, this guy was trying too hard to be artistic when the story itself was so good and he's getting such excellent performances out of his actors. A little bit over-directed, perhaps.
Yeah, there was times when we were like up somebody's nostril and I'm like, I'm not sure where we're going with this.
Not necessary.
Not necessary. But it was a wonderful experience, and I happened to see it on a horrific day this weekend with the news of the hostages, and
yeah.
It felt absolutely fantastic to be in a theater with 100% like Jews. It was a very nice feeling.
You saw it in New York?
No, actually, I saw it in Montclair, New Jersey.
Montclair, New Jersey. Well, yes. 100% Jews is certainly possible there.
Yes.
As well. I saw it at the Austin Film Society in Austin, Texas. So I highly doubt it was 100% Jewish. That is a, unless you're going to Rosh Hashanah evening services, it's kind of hard to come by around here. But, you know, it was actually what I saw. The theater was just mostly like people over the age of 60.
I was by far the youngest, and I'm not a spring chicken, but
I well, and that's the thing. It's like, but you know, I felt like, look, I think this movie, it has some flaws as a film. But I was just thinking about my late parents and how much they would have loved it, right? Because there was so much in it that they could relate to. That, you know, the going to temple, the dumb little fundraisers, the food, the kvetching, you know.
Yeah, and the boredom of the classes. We can all relate to, you know, when you study, it's kind of a slog.
It's dreadful, really. Like going through a bar mitzvah. The party is usually pretty fun, but and going to the other people's parties is always fun, but it's like a birthday on steroids. But you know, it's like the actual like studying. It's kind of rough business. You know, you have to sing in another language. You have to, you know, you're not always under the tutelage of someone who you like or respect. You know, but I felt like this was such a there was nothing self-hating about this movie. I felt like this is a movie that had a lot of affection for Jewish people and for Jewish culture.
What I love too is that it was such a relief. There was not a single thing in there, as often are stuck into Jewish movies. I'm thinking of the movie Munich, for example, where there's these moments of like, you know, why am I a Zionist? There was just nothing like that. It was just a movie about people who were Jewish and were struggling, and here's the thing that happened. There was an event and awful tragedies that happened to people. And here's how they moved on without a single discussion about, you know, Israel.
Right. They weren't struggling with anti-Semitism. They were just—
Not at all. They were just struggling with bad things that have happened to them in their lives.
Right. They were normal people who happened to be Jewish. And, yes. You know, you and I, we've talked about this before on the show, but like, there's so much fraught dialogue about being a Jew these days. And then, but there are also so many wonderful slice of life movies about other communities.
Yes.
It was nice. Is this my favorite movie of all time? No. Is it my favorite Jewish movie of all time? It is not. But it was nice to see that a movie like this can still get made and can still play in theaters and then people can go see it and just kind of relax a little bit about being a Jew.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And it was wonderful, especially because the person that you love most is Carla, and she's a person whose religion was denied to her as a child, and she wanted it back, and she'd gone her whole life wanting it, and that was perhaps one of the last things that she's going to do in this world is reclaim a Jewish identity, and I found that incredibly affirming and wonderful.
Yeah, Carla is the Carol Kane character.
Yes.
Carla Kessler, so clearly a part written specifically for Carol Kane. And again,
absolutely.
Again, you can't say enough about her performance. She's so real. And there's even a bit where she's a music teacher, but she also like had a brief flirtation with being like a 1970s folk singer. Right?
Yeah.
Like a la, like, I don't know, Laura Nyro or Nero or, you know, a little sort of regional Joni Mitchell sort of person.
Yeah.
And they play a little bit, they play a little bit of one of her songs, and it's just like, and the movie really, really fills that, her out. And you really believe that this is the house she lives in, and these are the things in her, you know, the whole thing is very, feels very, very lived in.
Yeah. And it was, and the Cantor obviously felt drawn to that house too, that open space, the beauty, the landscape. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Not to have, for example, a neurotic city Jew, but people who were absolutely embracing the world around them and finding something beautiful in that.
Do you know where that, I mean, they say it's upstate New York, but I'm not an East Coaster, so I'm not, do you know specifically where that is? Is that a made up town?
It's a made up town. It's supposed to be sort of like maybe Catskills or Adirondacks type place, you know, like a sort of a really nice rural community, not quite like Woodstock. It didn't have a hippie feel to it, but it just felt like a really beautiful, maybe 100 miles outside of the city kind of suburb.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. It was very, very suburban and like maybe a bit of a university town.
Yes. Yeah. It's definitely, yeah, the people were sophisticated. One of his mothers is a, you know, successful real estate agent. It's obviously a nice place to live.
Yeah. I would feel safe being a Jew there. I thought I didn't like the restaurant and bar stuff so much. I thought that big menu in the restaurant was kind of shticky. There were a few things that were, a few things that were a little off, right? There, again, it's an indie film. So, you know, it was like you're subject to Nathan Silver's incredibly quirky choices. At all turns, but again, you know, it's a movie that made me happy to be Jewish, and I'm, you know, that's a mitzvah.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. That the end of it is unbelievably positive, life affirming, and I walked out of there feeling infinitely better than I had when I walked in.
That's a strong endorsement. I agree that's the last scene. Silver finally just kind of like puts his, you know, lets his camera stand still. And just like pulls back and shows the characters doing the thing. And that I felt like the last couple of minutes were like, you know, A+ perfect.
A+. And anytime there's a regular movie without it being some kind of weird little side note where someone is chanting in Hebrew, my soul swells with joy. It was a wonderful moment.
Right. They're not doing it while there's a massacre going on outside or something.
No. And there was nothing. I guess that's the thing, is that it was marvelously free of politics.
Yeah.
For once.
Yeah, for sure.
It was just people having a, like I said before, grappling with some personal tragedies, not political ones, and finding a way to still communicate with God in a sense, even if you don't have to believe.
Yeah, very true. All right. Well, that's Between the Temples, and it is, you know, airing some places, and I'm sure it'll appear on street. I don't know where. I mean, you know, it depends on where you're living, if you're going to get to actually see this other than on streaming. But
it's playing everywhere. All the, you know, nice sort of independent theaters in New York are showing it.
Probably Between all the temples, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And if you're in a town with a film society or some indie theaters, it's probably on the menu. Right now, you can even go see it on a Friday night.
They would probably encourage it.
yeah, and bring your own brisket. All right, Rebecca Kirsten, thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, Becky Kirsten, thank you so much. Between the Temples is now in theaters wherever there are Jewish people, and even some places where there are not Jewish people, but mostly where there are Jewish people. It is a very, very Jewish movie, and that is a good thing. Not so good is the Hollywoodland exhibit at the Academy Museum in Los Angeles. Thank you to Michael Kaplan for agreeing to come on the podcast and talk to me about the efforts of the current Jews of Hollywood to call attention to what is bad about that exhibit. I don't know if we're winning necessarily, but I think it's important to put a marker down and say, no, this is not acceptable in 2024. And we'll continue to do things like that on this show and on the website on www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I am Neil Pollack. I am the host of this show. I am the editor of that site. I would be your friend if I were to meet you in person. I'm very friendly that way. And I thank you so much for reading the site and listening to the show. And I'll be back next week with more exciting content. And I'll talk to you soon.
Original production.
The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.